The Guardian.
Guardian Podcast, sponsored by audible.co.uk. For a free download, be sure to check out guardian.co.uk/free download, where Guardian listeners can choose any audiobook for free. See the page for more details.
Welcome back to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. This week on the show, we meet one-time cheeky child actor turned mature director, Dexter Fletcher, discusses his debut, Wild Bill. I also meet the Italian filmmaker Paolo Sorrentino to discuss his forthcoming work, This Must Be the Place, starring Sean Penn in a lot of makeup. And I'll be joined by Zan Brooks to review some of this week's other releases, including sci-fi thriller The Hunger Games, and the Dardenne brothers are back and on their bike, with the kid with a bike. Yes, it's the podcast with extra gears. It's Film Weekly. The actor Dexter Fletcher retains a near iconic status for a generation of British film and TV viewers. From the part he played as the young Caravaggio in Derek Jarman's idiosyncratic biopic, to pie fights in Bugsy Malone, the teen series Press Gang, and the film of Martin Amis's The Rachel Papers, as well, of course, as the Brit-era-defining caper of Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. But it's fair to say that perhaps his acting career hasn't exactly made him a star. However, he may have more luck as a director. This week reveals the results of him stepping behind the camera for the first time to direct his own script on Wild Bill, the story of a former drug dealer and lowlife, played by Charlie Creed Miles, who returns to his East London patch after prison to find himself, the landscape and his family much changed, putting his old ways under threat.
Are you on the game then?
Blimey, you know outlines, don't you?
Wait, do you know anything about baking? Well, it was. I missed my son's birthday. I was going to, like,
bake him a cake?
Yeah.
How old is he?
16.
16? And you're baking him a cake?
Well, yeah, I mean, that was the plan.
I'm sure he'll be blown away by it. You're getting him an action man and all.
Scene from Wild Bill there, and I'm thrilled to be joined on the line by its writer and director, Dexter Fletcher. Now, the morning after the premiere of The Night Before, you feeling all right, Dexter?
Well, you're going to have to excuse me if my answers don't make too much sense, I suppose. We did have a rather big night. My head's, it's a bit swollen. I feel like my brain's a bit swollen.
But you knew that it was going to be a big night because the film itself is about family, and it felt, the way that the film worked, that it was about a big family, friends getting together. There were so many of your old muckers in there, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's been the part of the huge joy of it for me, obviously, because, like you say, all my old friends and all my old muckers are there, and they all pitch in. And I was always determined that the film, you know, felt like a family affair, because it's, like you say, it's about family and it needs that kind of, that heart and centre. And so what was a byproduct of getting all the mates in and all the people who I love, and a friend of mine, is that it kind of created this bond and trust, and which is really conducive for a kind of a healthy working atmosphere.
Yeah, you know, I mean, obviously people like Jason Fleming, you've known for years, and we've known them as well, and we've also known you on screen for years as well. Growing up, did they always know that you wanted to be a director, and that they were thinking, Dexter wants me to be in a film that he's making? It's all right if Dexter wants us to act together, but he's making this film. How do we trust him? We know what he's like.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, Fleming certainly did, because he and I are really old mates and very close, and he and I spoke about getting projects together off the ground before, which always kind of got half started and didn't, you know, because he would get a job or I would get an acting job and we'd all go off in different directions. And then I was doing a TV show which finished, and I was kind of in between jobs, and that gave me a window that I kind of took advantage of. But I don't know. I mean, I don't think it comes as any surprise to any actors. You know, if Olivia Williams suddenly rocked up and went, hey, you know, I've got this project I really love and I'm going to direct it, I wouldn't be surprised, you know. And the same as, you know, I think every actor you get to a certain level, not every actor, but there's people you're like, okay, look, there's a window of opportunity here. There's a moment that I can maybe, you know, take like you know, Paddy Considine and even Joe Cornish to a large extent. You know, people who come from in front of the camera and move behind it.
I mean, because in the end, you've come out with, I mean, you, on the surface, I would call it a social realist story. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's council estate, mm-hmm. it's kind of got, it's yeah. London, it's the things that you know as well. But in a way, you've done so many different types of films. Actually, you could have ended up doing, I don't know, a teen film, Rachel Papers style in the kind of the American model. Do you know what I mean? I wasn't sure what you would come out with.
Yeah, I mean, I think whatever I wanted to do, I did want it to have a, you know, so maybe saying it's kind of crass, but a commercial ability about it, a commercial sensibility, at least to take whatever film it was and wherever it was set, what the story I was telling, to at least, you know, have an appeal that people would want to go and see it. And I think what's important about Bill, or what works about it, is that the heart of the story could really be set anywhere. What I chose to do was set it in a world that I knew very well, and give it a firm foot in a world that I kind of had experience of. I mean, you know, it goes down some rather dark avenues, but I didn't take it too far down any road that I didn't know myself.
Yeah, interestingly, right. you're not in it yourself. Were you tempted to put yourself in it?
No.
It's a great part. You've written a great lead part. Charlie Creed-Miles is fantastic in as Bill, but you must have thought, oh, I could, you know, I haven't had a lead like that for quite a long time myself.
No, I mean, maybe that is part of it as well. Yeah, that, you know, kind of like there's this secret hankering to get up. I mean, it is a great part. From an acting point of view, if I was an actor presented with that, I'd be like, wow, this is really good stuff. And I think, obviously, maybe that part of the strength of it is kind of my own frustration of not having a part of that good for the last few years. It kind of allows me to write the dream up. But I knew, I think, ultimately, going behind the camera, that I wouldn't be able to, you know, keep both of those things in the air.
It's a big responsibility, isn't it? I mean, tell us a little bit about how you came up with the idea for the part, for the role, because I mean, it is about Wild Bill, and how you chose Charlie. I mean, the last time I saw Charlie Creed-Miles, he was rapping on a stage in a street festival in Kentish Town. Then the next time I see him, he is absolutely tearing it up on screen and brilliant as this man who's come out of jail and seen his two kids growing up, and he's growing up, I suppose, at the same time, because he obviously went to jail and he was a bit of an idiot.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was it. I mean, it's personal in the fact that, you know, I, as a child actor, I had sort of this kind of adult responsibility, and you're under the same pressures as an adult, even as a child on the set. But then as an adult, I'd spent all these years playing kids, and I hadn't really learned to grow up. So I had this very different idea about the main character is a man who hadn't grown up, and, you know, his son was a young man who had a lot of adult responsibility. So that's really kind of the kernel of it. And then it was about finding a way to bring these characters together and kind of answer some questions in each other. And that gave me a chance to deal with the father-son kind of relationship and finding a way of making Charlie become the man and the father that he never really gave himself credit for, that character Bill.
Yeah.
So that was the jumping off point. And then, like, you know, I stuck him in prison because how do you keep someone from growing up for 20 years? And that seemed like a good solution to that anyway.
Yeah.
So it sort of organically grew. But really the heart of it is having that man who's still a boy and meeting his son who teaches him how to be a man and a father.
It's interesting. You mentioned you were a child actor, and everyone, you know, from my generation and yours, still remembers you as that. There's a sort of generation thing going on in the film. Inside the film, there's this generation thing you've just described very well. But sort of on the meta side of it, the outside of it, there's you now growing up from a child actor. You've become a director, and I'm sure you should do it again because I loved the film, and I think it's got great. It's got drama, it's got wit, it's got style, elegance. It's kind of fun. So you should be doing it again. That's number one. But also, you're using a lot of young actors. You're using young actors. Will Poulter, who we've seen grow up on screen. My God, he's got tall. He was only little in Son of Rambo, and now he's, look at him. He's tall as anything. Is there there's an element of now you're the generation? You mentioned Jason Fleming, and there's Mark Warren in there as well. You know, you're sort of taking responsibility. You know, you're now responsible for the future of British cinema. There's a sort of baton passing going on there.
Wow. Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, look, it was just a great opportunity to really go and find this young talent and get them involved. And I don't know, it's a part of the story. I needed to create this life for this young man. You know, I had all this kind of adult responsibility. And it's just a real joy to meet those young actors and work with them. And then suddenly it becomes very resonant for me as someone who acted for all those years as a young person himself. to be able to sort of explore what it is. And I mean, I kind of was just sort of left to get on with it, I always felt. You know, it was kind of like, hey, you're doing well, and you're working, and everyone says you're great, off you go. And there's a certain element of people kind of leaving your own devices, and that maybe wasn't so healthy for me in the long run.
Yeah.
I suppose, like, you know, certainly for Sammy Williams, someone like that who's 14, I think, you know, he's a very talented young man.
He's in Attack the Block as well, and plays Jimmy in your film, the youngest boy.
Yeah. And, you know, it's going to be an interesting time. Hopefully he'll get lots of work, and he's very talented. But there will be some waters that will need navigating for him. You know, he'll go from a young man to, you know, a boy to a man. And that's what Will's going through and has kind of successfully transcended, it seems, at the moment. You know, he's 19, he's very serious about his acting, you know, he studies, and he's really into the craft of it, and as well as being talented, which is obviously always a good combination. But I think, obviously, I have a natural kind of affinity and kind of care for people in that position because I've been there myself.
Did they know you? I mean, I'm sure they don't. I don't know if Press Gang's on DVD box set or anything, but...
Yeah, I don't know if it really... I mean, you know, I've popped up in Misfits now and again, and there's, Musketeers, and I'm like, still popping up in things that they might know. But, I mean, Will claims that he knew exactly who I was. I suspect he probably didn't, but that doesn't matter. You know, he and I became firm friends and very quickly. So.
Yeah.
But I don't know. They know who I am now.
Well, you know, there's a different you, I think. I mean, you always say when a director puts their soul up there, and it was lovely. I mean, as I've known you for quite a long time, it's quite nice. It is lovely to see that it was true to yourself.
Yeah.
Also, musically as well, I loved your choice of tunes. Eddie Grant, The Clash, Guns of Brixton, and then Eddie Grant, and then Chocolate Milk in there as well.
Wow.
Action Spit Loud on the
Deck.
70s funk collection you've leafed through.
Yeah, I did. Went through the old vinyl, pulled out a few favourites. You know, Hercules in there,
Aaron Neville.
And, he's in there. But Mark Hollis as well from Talk Talk is a great track. He's sort of an 80s throwback. I know. I mean, that's one of the great indulgences, but also one of the most wonderful things about when you're putting the film together and you get to do your first assembly after you've shot it all and you kind of put together the big version with everything in it, and it's 2 hours and 15 minutes long, and you just sort of drop tracks on it that you always imagined that you wanted to hear.
How long have you been waiting to drop some of those tracks? If I make a movie one day, I'm going to put that Eddie Grant, I'm going to put Can You Feel My Love, Eddie Grant in there.
I know, because we were looking for a track at the end of it, and I don't know how I came across it again. I mean, it's totally from my youth, you know. And I was like, oh, yeah. And it was like, it's kind of so on the nose. But I think that the film's been through such a journey by that point that maybe you just go, okay, it just brings that smile. Because it was really important to me that people could come out of the theatre with a smile and feel some sort of sense of positivity and kind of like, okay, we went on this journey and came out somewhere good.
They do.
And it just sort of, it just tied it up nicely for me. It's sort of a bit tongue-in-cheek.
Well, me too as well. It was, tongue-in-cheek, but that's you all over, Dex. I also love the suggestion that, the Olympics is going on, and I love this. I love the backdrop, and your cinematographer, George Richmond, I think, has done a great, great job capturing that element.
Absolutely.
I love the suggestion that, you know, there's the Olympic site, and, you know, we know the gang, the kind of, you know, the nefarious activities that go on in the East End of London.
Yeah.
Suggestion that there are maybe a few bodies lying in that Olympic stadium in the concrete.
That's a great line. You're going to end up as a permanent fixture in this stadium. I mean, it's just too good to miss, too good a chance to miss, really. I mean, you know, it's about playing around with the sort of like the preconceptions of it anyway, but allowing ourselves to have fun, you know. And I'm no delusions with some guys around there throwing those kind of threats around, idle or otherwise, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
The thing is about, you know... Sorry.
Go on, Uncle.
No, I was just going to say, you know, there is still life going on under the shadow of this huge investment and this stadium, and it's still going on there. And I think it was just a real bonus for us to just have that stadium sitting there doing the work that it did. I mean, it was literally changing before our very eyes as we shot over that period. And It was just interesting because his favourite came with just a reflective of Bill and the man and his journey. And so I just realised I didn't really need to do a lot with it. It just needed to be there doing what it was doing, and it could make its own statement.
Well, very smart. And please God, the film's still playing when the Olympics is on and it becomes a kind of synonymous film with the the London Olympics.
Yeah. That would be lovely. I would love that.
Well, I loved it. It's a real pleasure to have you on the show, Dexter. Congratulations on Wild Bill. You can feel my love from Film Weekly. We loved it here. Thanks a lot.
Really do appreciate that, Jason. It's really important, and I'm really chuffed that you like it so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Cheers, mate.
Thank you.
And Wild Bill is on UK-wide release from this Friday, the 23rd of March. From Wild Bill to the Bucking Bronco, joining me now is Guardian's Zan Brooks to run down the rest of the week's releases. It's a light week, Zan, but an important week, I think. We're going to look at The Hunger Games. We're going to look at the Darden brothers back with a kid with a bike. And I'll also talk to you about This Must Be the Place, if I may, the Paolo Sorrentino movie. But let's start with Wild Bill, because we've just heard from Dexter. Did you like Wild Bill?
I liked it way more than I thought I would. I went in with a whole, rat's nest of prejudices, thinking it was going to be another geezer comedy played out on the estates with lots of brashness and bling, which it is. It is that. And yet it has a heart to it, and it has some appealingly rough edges to it as well.
Yeah, I thought so too. And I thought it was funny, and I thought it maintained its drama all the way through. I mean, there is a good story here, and I think that's key. They got a script that they went with and was strong enough.
Yeah, it's a script that I think Dexter Fletcher wrote with the novelist Danny King.
That's right.
Great performance from Charlie Creed-Miles. I mean, it's that odd thing, isn't it, that Dexter Fletcher and Charlie Creed-Miles are almost the kind of almost men of British cinema, that sort of 15 years ago you kind of thought these are the ones to watch, and for whatever reason it never quite happened for either of them, and yet this is this sort of weird late bloom, and they found each other, and it's, I hesitate to say it's a beautiful marriage, but it's certainly compelling.
It's because Charlie Grimaldi, as you mentioned, Neil by Mouth, he was very strong in that, the heroin addict younger kid in that, and Dexter was child career we've known for a long time. They've been buzzing around, and it feels like it really has, they've kind of landed here. I think Charlie's fantastic in this role, actually.
Yeah, and if we're looking at the next generation of nearly men of British acting, a great performance from Will Poulter, who we know from Son of Rambo, and also was he Eustace in the last Narnia film
as
well? He was very good in that.
He was.
He's playing Dean, the sort of angry, stoic older son of Charlie Creed-Miles' character, and it's a great performance from him.
Yeah, I remember sitting next to him at the premiere of Son of Rambo at the London Film Festival, however many years it was, 6 years ago, and I sort of sat next to him and I said, oh, you're very good in that. He goes, oh, thank you very much, sir. And now here
he wouldn't say that now.
No, he wouldn't.
He'd say, I know.
I'm bloody brilliant, he'd say. But it was very, very sweet. But it's amazing to see that they've grown up and he's so tall. I thought this was really funny, really sweet, and there's a beautiful scene with the aeroplane. And we had Dexter on, I wasn't going to explain the magic of how they follow this paper aeroplane, and Charlie goes, wow, it's going all the way to Stoke Newington, that one, and it just flies, this kind of describes this arc around London that just looks just so beautiful. That moment of lightness, that kind of really kind of is emblematic of the
place. And you really need it at that moment, because it is mired in the estates and the pubs of its milieu. But the great gift of this film is that it does have the sense of the wider world and the possibilities of those lives.
With the Olympics as the background as well. So you've got the world coming there as well. And they've got these Polish builders everywhere. My favourite line, I think, the whole thing is like, shut up and build me a velodrome. And he just gives the bloke a saw and gets going. It must be so weird to be in that area and see this kind of Olympic park spring up, and yet you're clinging to your old ways. For me, it's one of the surprises of the year so far.
One of the nicest surprises
of the British film-going year so far. Zan, perhaps we can look at another surprise. The Hunger Games is out this week, starring Jennifer Lawrence, who we've had an eye on for a very long time, particularly in Winter's Bone. She garnered her an Oscar nomination. Here, she plays Katniss, a girl who's been picked to represent her district in the Hunger Games. Transported to the capital to prepare for the ordeal, she meets the personal stylist, Cinna, who is, in fact, Lenny Kravitz.
I'm sorry that this happened to you. I'm here to help you in any way that I can.
Most people just congratulate me.
Well, I don't see the point in that. So tonight, they have the tribute parade. I'm gonna take you out and show you off to the world.
So you're here to make me look pretty?
I'm here to help you make an impression. Now, usually they dress people in the clothes from their district.
Yeah, we're always coal miners.
Yeah, but I don't want to do that. I want to do something that they're gonna remember. Did they explain about trying to get sponsors?
Yeah, but I'm not very good at making friends.
There she is, Jennifer Lawrence. Funny, in Winter's Bone, I remember reviewing it with you when we talked about how the recipe for squirrel stew was rather important.
Yeah.
Basically, at the start of this, she threatens to cook the cat and then is kind of, you know, harpooning wildlife rather quickly.
This is what I was thinking when I was watching it. I was thinking, this is like Winter's Bone, the Hollywood sequel, where you know, the suits in Hollywood thought, Winter's Bone, that's great, but what it needs in there is a reality show in which all the teens kill each other.
Yeah.
And we'll still keep the actress because she's really good, but we'll get her to play basically the same role. And she's an impoverished child of the Appalachians who steps in when her little sister is selected via lottery to compete in this dystopian nightmare game, which is a kind of American pop idol, but with bricks and axes and bows and arrows.
Yeah.
And is then transported to this god-awful futuristic city that looks like Oz gone wrong. It's this sort of weird, decadent place where everybody has dyed, pomaded hair.
The kind of Willy Wonka type. Willy Wonka is the kind of fashion guru.
Yeah, there. And you've got a fantastic performance from Stanley Tucci as the grinning David Letterman-esque TV host, who's just this oleaginous insincerity oozing out of every pore. It's one of those rare things that I think it is a Hollywood blockbuster that actually has a bit of punch and a bit of weight behind it. It's obviously based on the Suzanne Collins young adult bestseller, which, not being a young adult, I've neglected to read. and I imagine it's reasonably faithful, almost to a fault, in that there are three books in the series and there's a sense of a kind of winding down at the end of this film, yeah, where you want it to kind of hit sixth gear.
It sort of suffers from that thing that all Hollywood films now, is, yeah, that they never bloody end.
Yeah,
they just kind of leave it open. And it's bloody annoying, I think.
It is annoying.
And they changed the rules halfway through. I mean, I really enjoyed it too.
I think that was fine. But yeah, that is the one problem that I had with this film is that it does seem to be building, 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 and then it tails off. But
it's not just because of the franchise. I think that there is a fault there that they do change. I like a film that sort of says, this is the rules of the game, and you know they can win it if they do. And then they kind of, it gets a bit like, well, we'll change that, and then we'll do that. I don't know if that's because it's about the puppet mastery of the kind of reality TV game that we're watching. Something was lacking. I know everyone loves The Hunger Games. It seems a bit heretic to say so. Yes, for a blockbuster, it's really good. It's got a cool indie spirit. It was directed by Gary Ross, who made Pleasantville
Twilight,
which was a very smart film about entering a TV, going in the black and white world, and colour coming to Joan Allen after an orgasm. I thought very smart, and he's obviously kind of obsessed by these layers of TV reality.
Yeah.
That's what we've got here. That's a in this one, I thought the start was really good. It just got a bit long for me, and I was like, well, what are the Hunger Games? And I didn't get enough idea that everyone was watching the Hunger Games.
There's that had slight sort of budgetary problems, I worried, at some point where you just see, like, you know, 10 people gathered around a big screen watching it, and yet you're supposed to think that millions and millions and millions are sort of glued to this, and there's this great unrest out in the world.
In a way to keep them stupid, because Donald Sutherland, yes, who's the sort of king of this world, kind of,
yes,
says we do it to kind of extinguish hope, keep hope going. I don't quite know.
Also, slight problem with these films that you're set up, there's all the competitors, but you never really get to know them apart from maybe two or three.
And then suddenly that one word is very important, and you're supposed to go, oh, I'm sorry, he's dead. I didn't even know he was there.
Yeah.
I did have problems with it.
I had many less problems, though. I really enjoyed this. I thought that, you know, Gary Ross, it's a worn secondhand old script, really, in terms of the conceit of it. I was thinking of the Richard Bachman books that Stephen King wrote under a nom de plume.
Oh yeah,
You know, which was made into the Arnold Schwarzenegger film,
The Running Man.
Yeah. You know, it's got a bit of
Battle Royale,
Rollerball,
yeah,
in
the Lord
there.
Of the Flies. Must
Lord
be in
of the
there,
Flies.
I was just reminded of the Tomorrow People. I'm just going to be talking to Dexter
Fletcher
about
It's all in there.
Gang.
It's all that kind of dystopian sci-fi, and yet, like the best dystopian sci-fi, it completely plays it straight. Yeah, There's no kind of jokiness.
It wasn't
in
that
here.
Dystopian, which is what, because I don't like dystopian sci-fi when it's all Philip K. Dick and everyone's raining and there's steam coming up and everyone's a kind of and everyone's a robot in the employ of the state. It had sunlight in it. It was done during the daytime. So I've enjoyed that, and I think that maybe we enjoyed it most because Jennifer Lawrence, she damn good.
She's really good, isn't she? I mean, she is the Sigourney Weaver Ripley of this generation, I think, in that she's not ingratiating at all.
Yeah.
She sort of barely cracks a smile in this film. It's a performance of incredible kind of solemnity, and yet she's sort of hard-ass as well. And I can imagine teenage girls kind of absolutely going nuts for this film.
Yeah, I mean, she's not Lara Croft. There's no Tomb Raider-y element. She's not kick-ass.
She's not sexual. It's a weirdly kind of chaste film, really, considering it's full of kind of teens and 20-somethings. But it's a power. powerful performance from her.
Yeah, I'd have just liked a little bit more about the hunger, if you like. I don't.
Yeah,
quite
less
get
games, more hunger.
Yes, that's what I would have liked.
Okay,
but you know, fair enough. I think we're going to get more of them.
One out of
like
two ain't bad.
Yeah, exactly. That's the Hunger Games, which Zan recommends heartily. It's 2.5 hours. I was a bit I do love Jennifer Lawrence very much, and Lenny Kravitz I like too.
Lenny Kravitz is good. Harrelson as the Woody boozy Harrelson. Old mentor is very good.
Very good. Well, yes, I mean, and Gary Ross, well done for directing.
Absolutely, yeah.
Kind of, and Tom Stern, the cinematographer, who's I think been a bit boring of late when he's been doing Clint Eastwood's work. Here got led off the leash here and was allowed to kind of do quick cutting and looking quite good.
So, yeah, but that's an occupational hazard if you're working with Clint these days, isn't it?
I think it really
is. He drags you down.
Doesn't he? God, thank God I'm not working with that Clint Eastwood. Let's talk about the Dardennes, talking of people who are kind of got places in the international cinema canon. Holder of 2 Palme d'Or, Jean-Luc Dardenne. They won for Rosetta and they won for...
The Sun?
Le Fils? I never know which one they win for. They're all the same to me.
The child,
I thought the that uncle. Up till now, that recently the Dardennes have been a bit of a busted flush. I've kind of got their kind of social realism from their kind of blighted northern industrial areas of France and Belgium where the two worlds meet. However, they are back now with The Kid with a Bike, starring Cécile de France adopting a rather spiky 11-year-old.
Oui, concierge.
C'est Cyril, je voudrais rentrer chez mon père.
Quel Cyril?
Cyril Catoul, mon père habite au 5e.
Il n'habite pas ici, il est parti, hein, moi.
Mais il y a son nom sur la sonnette.
Ton père n'habite plus là, il est parti. Faut que t'acceptes.
Then, it's as if The Kid with the Bike has got the Dardennes to shift gear a little bit.
It's a more conventional plot, I guess, this one, in the same way that... In the same can, you had Nuri Bilge Ceylan making Once Upon a Time in Anatolia that came out a few weeks ago, that they have kind of hitched their wagon to a more conventional film narrative. That's not to say that they've sold out at all. And if anything, it gives this film a momentum. And it is a film about momentum. It's a film about flight. It's the character of Cyril, who's this 11-year-old boy, another great performance from Thomas Doré, who's just kind of running, really. He's abandoned by his dad. Yeah. He's being held by the social services. And then later on, fostered by Samantha, who's a hairdresser played by Cécile de France. But he's running, and it's about the kind of the flight to safety, to find love, but the way in which that flight can then eventually just become a flight, that you are just escaping all the time.
It's a common Dardenne trope. I mean, in Rosetta, yeah. that she does that as well, and in The Sun.
And I think probably all goes back to, 400 Blows, the Truffaut film back in 1959 yeah. or whatever, about the...
There's a Dickensian element to this one, though.
Yeah, you're going even further back.
Yeah, I'm going further
back. I'm going back to The Odyssey.
It's all walking. I just thought they had this one. If I'd never seen a Dardenne, I would start with this one and work.
Yeah,
backwards.
I think so. And I'm finding that I'm just comparing all these films to other films, but this one struck.
You're showing your vast cinematic knowledge.
Yeah, yeah, so. or just laziness on my part. This is almost like a weird shotgun wedding of Bicycle Thieves and Pinocchio.
Yeah,
isn't it? That it is. The child who wants to be good, but there are temptations everywhere, and eventually falls in with, like, older kid who's drug dealer,
yeah.
And everything's teetering on the precipice.
And I think our colleague Peter Bradshaw has written about the sort of rather cartoonish whack on the head when
yes,
birds
that's
go
right, yeah.
around the head, and he wakes up and goes, oh, but it's,
yeah.
There is that element, which I think Ken Loach does as well sometimes in his teenage films, like Sweet 16, lots of kids on bikes running around. It gets a bit Grange Hilly.
Yeah, a bit Children's Film Foundation,
yeah,
isn't
I
it?
I don't mind that.
I don't really mind it. I think it's in keeping with the spirit of those worlds, aren't they? I mean, obviously, Loach's films and this one are not going to be watched by 10-year-olds. They're just not.
But, I mean, Kez is, isn't it? I think...
I don't know, really?
In schools, isn't it? I don't know. I would, if I were a 10-year-old, or if I had a 10-year-old, which one day I will, I might say, well, if you're going to watch the Dardennes, watch it.
You're going to adopt
hate
one?
Me. I might have to after... If I show my eldest one this one, I might then have to
I think one. I think a kid... You'd have to drag a kid kicking and screaming to Kez. I think that said, if they went with it, they'd get a lot out of it, but it's certainly not going to be, they're going to go and see the Hunger Games, aren't they?
I don't know. If I adhere to the Mark Cousins and Tilda Swinton 8.5 Film Foundation, they'll be watching Iranian films about balloons.
It's never going to happen.
That is The Kid with a Bike, which we like. I like Cécile de France as well as this.
Yeah, she's great.
A really different role for her. I mean, talking of blockbusters.
And great use of music. Is it Beethoven, the refrain from Beethoven that runs through this?
And their regular Jérôme Grenier as the reluctant dad in there is also rather good in there. So we like this Dardennes version.
Yeah,
it's
a good proper films.
We thought it might. Yeah, what a week for proper films. Even The Hunger Games is a proper film.
It is, yeah.
For Hollywood. I'm going to talk to Paolo Sorrentino in a minute, Zan. So I just wanted to get you to set up this
one. Ask him why. What was he thinking? Ask him.
Perché? I shall say. This must be the place. Sean Penn as a goth, basically.
Yeah, Sean Penn as a Robert Smith lookalike goth whose career is now behind him and is wandering around Ireland, you know, sitting in cafes and playing games on the lawn with his wife, played by Frances McDormand. As is always the way with retired goth rockers, he's called over to America to go in search of Nazis.
Yeah. That's
it, and it's one of the oddest films I saw last year.
Yeah, isn't Palace Omnium always odd? I mean, not in Il Divo as such, but in, you know, the family friend and the consequences. Like he is,
but I think the combination of that and a Hollywood star and Sean Penn ups the ante of oddness. It's a captivating film. I'm not sure it quite holds together. But it certainly deserves many points for originality.
It certainly does. And a David Byrne soundtrack. So we're going to hear from Paolo, and maybe I'll ask him why he did it. I did ask him why he did it, because it is a bit odd. He met Sean Penn at Cannes. So it's a movie that's born of Cannes weirdness. And shows how people get a bit
distorted. How people get drunk and sign up to anything.
Yeah, in Cannes. This is how you got the gig.
That's
on
why
film
I'm wearing
weekly.
the Harlequins outfit.
Yeah, looks very nice. I like the single tier as well, working very nicely for you. Zan Brooks, as ever, thank you very much indeed for joining us, as you have all throughout Film Weekly over the years as well. If you want to read more about Zan and see more of Zan, go to guardian.co.uk/film.
I know how to sing.
I have no doubt that I don't know how to play.
That's not true. My mom said you were a singer.
He even sang with Mick Jagger.
Actually, Mick Jagger sang with me. It was his idea.
Wow, rock history revealed right here in our house, Tommy.
Can you play something, please? Just one song.
I don't play anymore. And besides, I don't even know if I remember how.
My music teacher said once you learn, you never forget.
Maybe he was just trying to be nice, or he wanted to worm some money out of you.
Please, just one.
What do you want me to play?
This Must Be the Place by Arcade Fire.
Nonsense. This Must Be the Place is by the Talking Heads.
No, it's by Arcade Fire.
Trust me, you're delusional. This Must Be the Place is by the Talking Heads. Arcade Fire merely did a cover.
Home is where I...
Where are you going? I was just seeing if the guitar was in tune.
Oh, sorry.
I'm with Paolo Sorrentino, the great director of Consequences of Love and a family friend, and now This Must Be the Place. He just told me he doesn't speak English, but I think he's lying. I know he speaks English. In fact, your film is in English. It's only called This Must Be the Place. You've got an English film, so you speak English.
I am not an actor in the movie. The other guys speak English, not me.
You have a fantastic actor in your movie, Sean Penn. Yeah. This is a film that I know was born at the Cannes Film Festival. Is that right?
Yeah. In part, it's true. Yeah, in Cannes Film Festival, Sean Penn said to me that it was a good idea to work together, and so I started to think about something for him, mm-hmm. and I had an old idea about a Nazi criminal war hidden in the United States, and so slowly I built the structure of the screenplay for him. Yeah,
it's fascinating because you say you had the old idea of a Nazi being hunted in the States, but your film, the first almost 40 minutes of it, take place entirely in Dublin, in a house in Dublin. So how did you get from Nazi hunter to Dublin with Sean Penn?
The opposite things in the movies work well together. So a guy like a rock star that doesn't know anything about the Holocaust is the best guy to find out where is hidden a Nazi war criminal. Mm. That's the first idea of this strange story. Yeah,
because I guess we go with him. We journey with him. We find out.
Yeah,
we get corrupted, if you like, with him. As the deeper into the journey we go.
Yeah. After a still moment, a long moment in Dublin, where The movie describes the life of this retired rock star. The movie moves in the United States, where in a slow way, as a characteristic of this character, he finds out the skills to find this guy, this old guy, more than 90 years old, that hidden in the mountains.
He becomes, in a way, he becomes from bored rock star to detective, but not detective just to find out where the Nazi's hidden, but detective to his own life.
Yeah, also, yeah, he has a double identity of detective, more traditional, and of course he understands something more about himself, about his relationship with his father, with his wife, and with all his still alive in Dublin. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Why did you choose the Holocaust, Paolo? Is that something that is in your family?
No, it's not in your family, but it's a topic that I was always really interested in it. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the topics that it's always important to talk about. And so there are many movies that speak very well about the Holocaust during the Second World War. I thought it was interesting speak about the Holocaust from the point of view of a guy that didn't live that period.
Yeah, and I guess your film shows how it connects to even the strangest life now, you know, 60 years on, it still connects to people you wouldn't imagine have connections to the Holocaust.
There are last situations about the Holocaust that are living now, because there are many Nazi war criminals are very old, and it's unbelievable, but they are alive. So there are many of these stories that you can go to find out around the world.
Yeah, the interesting thing is you in a way it's an American film. At least half of it is an American, half of it is the life of this man in Dublin, and yet you had made two such films, a very interesting new way of making films, Paolo. We like to refrescanti your style. Did you change your style because you think, well, I'm going to America, I'm going to do different genre, I'm going to be homage to American cinema?
No, I didn't change style, but this movie was definitely more simple than other movies I did. So in this case, I used a more simple style for a simple story. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was there any American filmmakers, or I suppose the great history of European filmmakers who've made films in America and given a special look on America because of their European view? Was there anyone that you were influenced by? Did you watch any films in advance of making yours?
The American cinematography is so important for a director that too many movies influenced me. So it's like no one movie influenced me. Mm-hmm. When there are too many things that give a pressure, for Paradox, you are free and you live without pressure. Yeah.
I mean, it's only because the family, friend, and the consequences stuff are so un-American in their way of telling that that it was kind of interesting to me to see what you would do. And it reminded me a bit of Paris, Texas, but a bit of the Coens. Obviously, you have Frances McDormand in there. Mm-hmm. This strange mix of, well, everything.
I don't know. The Coen brothers are my favorite director between the American directors of the day. So, and Fran McDormand is one of my favorite actresses. Mm-hmm.
What a dream to be able to get your favorite actress in the movie when you're making an American movie. I want her, and you get it.
Yeah, but I have to say that this movie is full of dreams that I realized about the actors, about the music, and it was a big dream, and I was lucky, and
Sean Penn and David Byrne. I mean, amazing. So tell me about working with Sean Penn. He's behind you. You can't see this because this is audio, but he's sitting behind you. And your hair, I notice, is now, when I met you in Cannes, it wasn't like this. Now you're growing your hair to match Sean Penn in the movie, as in Robert Smith in The Cure.
No. When I was young, I had the hair like Sean Penn in the movie. Not now. Now I am grown up and I have to cut.
No, it's pretty long, I can tell you. It's impressive.
But it's a mistake. When I come back to Italy, I have to cut.
And Sean Penn was happy with the costume, the look? Was that something you said to him, I want you to look like this? Or did he come up with the idea, I want to be like Robert Smith of The Cure behind closed doors?
No, I think that he was happy and he was very interested in about the change. A very good doctor is always interested about the mask.
And finally, it is a great mask that he puts, the white makeup, the red lipstick. This must be the place. It's, I suppose, now 2 years you've finished the film. Are you working on another film?
Not yet.
Oh.
I am becoming old. I have to go slowly.
Your hair will fall out.
Yeah, probably.
Molto grazie, Paolo Sorrentino. Another very original film from a very original director. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Ciao. A huge thanks, molto grazie, to Paolo Sorrentino, one of the most idiosyncratic and distinctive filmmakers to have emerged during the time I've been doing this show. His latest film, This Must Be the Place, gets its official release here in the UK on Friday, the 6th. Of April. And that's all for this week, our penultimate week of Film Weekly. The music we've been featuring on the show has been from This Must Be the Place, David Byrne, Talking Heads, a little bit of Eddie Grant in there, why not too? From me, Jason Solomons, and my trusty producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's see you next week for the last time. Goodbye.
Guardian Podcasts, sponsored by audible.co.uk. For a free download, be sure to check out guardian.co.uk/free download, where Guardian listeners can choose any audiobook for free. See the page for more details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.